afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome back once again to the National Press Club. My name is Richard Salmon. I'm a reporter with Congressional Quarterly, and I'm also on the Board of Governors here at the club. For all of them, we extend our welcome to you, and also to those of you watching this program today on C-SPAN, and those of you listening to the program on National Public Radio. Before introducing our head table, I'd like to remind our members of some upcoming speakers. On Thursday, June 24, Robert Strauss, the former ambassador to Russia, will be here to present a speech entitled Russia and Current Affairs. On Wednesday, June 30, Carol Browner, the administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency, will discuss environmental protection and children's health. And on Thursday, July 1, U.S. Attorney General Janet Reno will discuss her agenda for a criminal justice reform. Other upcoming luncheon speakers include South African President F.W. de Klerk, Postmaster General Marvin Runyon, Secretary of Health and Human Services Donna Shalala, and Secretary of Transportation Federico Pena. Audio and videotapes of Press Club luncheons are available through the National Press Club Library or by dialing 1-800-952-TAPE. Our guest today has lived part of his life submerged, but today has surfaced to tell us his story. Dr. Robert Ballard pioneered the use of manned and unmanned deep diving submersibles to explore the magnificent ocean depths. Using these unique machines, he led the first manned exploration of the mid-oceanic ridge, the largest mountain range on Earth. As chief scientist of an expedition in deep waters off the Galapagos Islands, he discovered life where none was known to exist. Huge tube worms, giant clams, and other marine animals, thriving 2 miles down near previously undiscovered plumes of hot minerals venting from the interior of the Earth. In 1985, he discovered and explored the remains of the lost luxury liner Titanic, resting in total darkness at the bottom of the Atlantic. He also discovered the German battleship Bismarck, sunk during World War II. Dr. Ballard's subsequent books on those discoveries became bestsellers. His first novel, Bright Shark, was released last year. He has another one in the works. Dr. Ballard established the Jason Foundation, which takes millions of American students on so-called electronic field trips by way of television. He has produced several television specials on his work, including the recently acclaimed account of the sea battle at Guadalcanal during World War II. He has also served as host of the popular National Geographic Explorer program. Later this summer, Dr. Ballard will undertake his next major exploration, the search for another lost luxury liner, Lusitania. It's not a surprise that his favorite book as a child was Jules Verne's 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. His hero, Captain Nemo. The National Press Club is honored to welcome the director of the Center for Marine Exploration at Woods Hole, Dr. Robert Ballard.
Thank you very much. It's indeed an honor to be here and to hear the speakers are going to be following me over subsequent days and weeks. I really feel honored that an undersea explorer has been able to have this forum and talk about some of our thoughts about the ocean and what may lie in front of us. But before doing that, I'd like to make a few observations that I think are driving the future in the ocean and certainly will have a great impact upon what ultimately occurs within the next 100 years. Modern research now suggests that all humans on the face of the Earth came from a common ancestry that can be traced back to the plains of Eastern Africa. And during the last 200,000 years, our ancestors journeyed forth from their birthplace to populate the planet. First, they crossed the large Eurasian landmass, but finally found a way to the New World during the waning years of the Great Ice Age, just a few tens of thousands of years ago. Now, many factors led to this global expansion of our forefathers. The excitement of exploration, a driving desire to escape oppression, a lust for economic gain, or simply to pursue a better life for themselves and their loved ones. For whatever reason, the fact remains our species now dominates the planet. We have all but conquered many of the forces that held us in check for oh so many millenniums. Instead of being controlled by the forces of nature, we are now beginning to control nature itself. Our activities have altered the ozone layer, led to a buildup of CO2 in the upper atmosphere, continued the destruction of the rainforest, as well as the continued premature extinction of many plants and animals that our species once lived in harmony with. By some estimates, there are more people today that are alive than have ever died since our species began to populate the planet. And that number will double again as we struggle through the next century. Now, despite the rhetoric of the need for population control, we continue to multiply. Entering an era where reproduction is now endangering our existence instead of ensuring our survival. During the Rio Convention on the Environment, for example, the impact of global population on the environment was not a major topic of discussion. It is still not a politically correct issue to raise. Perhaps the tombstone of our species will read, "The human race came and went because it was politically correct." But I'm not here to talk about how we're going to control the world's population. Even repressive measures in some countries have failed to accomplish that. I'm just an undersea explorer from the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution who would like to talk about man's relationship with the sea and what I think the future holds based upon our continued growth and need for space. Now, despite our globe-trotting ability, our species has not colonized any new land masses on the planet since the colonization of the New World, which began in the 15th century. And let us not forget that the New World was already inhabited by our species long before Columbus bumped into the Bahama Islands in 1492. Today, the primary activities of our species is still confined to less than 20% of the planet. Ironically, historically, our species has been held at bay by an aquatic world that has resisted our colonizing ways. Instead of turning to the sea, we turned our eyes, and I think our hearts, to the heavens, convinced that if we only tried, we could swim in the canals of Mars. We could grow tomatoes on Venus. Like Superman's race, which despite its intelligence destroyed the mother planet of Krypton and escaped to Earth, for many years we have been telling ourselves that we could escape our destruction of Earth and flee into space. Space was a convenient way out, a way we could avoid facing up to the destructive consequences of our unchecked behavior. To me, however, the most important image to come out of the space program was when an astronaut on his way to the moon trained his cameras back on Earth and captured an image of a very small blue-green planet embedded in a black velvet void of nothingness. Mars has no canals to swim in. The atmosphere of Venus is deadly to us. And we can't even land on Jupiter. And if we could, we lack the muscles in our bodies to even stand up and walk around. Space may be the last ultimate frontier, but with the public's disenchantment in the space program reflected in President Clinton's recent reductions in the space station program, I'm convinced to conclude that Earth is the immediate frontier we must explore. We now have better topographic maps of Venus than Earth. We know more about the physiography of small volcanic cones on the far side of the moon that has never faced our planet than similar features in our own economic zone off of America. When President Reagan signed the bill creating the EEZ, the size of America doubled. Yet most of this modern-day Louisiana Purchase, which was purchased for nothing, remains unexplored. And vast expanses of the ocean floor in the southern hemisphere have never had an oceanographic research vessel pass over them. The largest single feature on the surface of the Earth is the mid-ocean ridge, which runs for a distance of 70,000 kilometers around our planet like the seam on the baseball. This largest of our features covers almost a quarter of the Earth's total surface area. Almost 25% of the Earth's total surface area is one mountain range. Yet despite its tremendous size and the critical role it plays in the origin of the Earth's outer skin, Neil Armstrong walked on the moon, and others played golf and drove around in cars before the first human being entered the mid-ocean ridge Great Rift Valley in the summer of 1973. There are more active volcanoes underwater than on land. There are greater plains that dwarf those of America. Canyons far grander than the Grand Canyon. And the mighty Rocky Mountains would fit into a small portion of the mid-ocean ridge. Given the emergence of advanced robotic technology, fiber optics, microprocessing, virtual reality, autonomous vehicles, telecommunications, and a host of other new advances that are now taking place, the ocean is no longer a barrier to human activity. The deep abyss is now our backyard. And working at 20,000 feet, which represents 98% of the world's oceans, has become routine. Given our exploding population, given our diminished interest in the promises of the space program, and given the continued development of advanced technology, I truly believe the 21st century will usher in an explosion in human activity in the sea. I'm convinced that the next generation will explore more of Earth, that is the 71% of us that's underwater, than all previous generations combined. And just as Lewis and Clark's exploration of the Louisiana Purchase led to the settling of the West, the exploration of the sea will lead to its subsequent colonization. The gathering and hunting of the living resources of the sea, an activity characterized by primitive societies on land, will be replaced at sea by farming and herding. High technology barbed wire in the form of acoustic, thermal, and other barrier techniques will emerge to control and manage the living resources of the oceans. The same debates now underway over the destruction of the rainforest's diversity on land in favor of ranching and farming will repeat itself at sea as the great biodiversity of our world's barrier reefs are threatened by large-scale farming of the sea. Oil and gas exploration will continue moving into deeper and deeper waters. We have already discovered and mapped proven oil reserves at depths of 12,000 feet, which represents the average depth of the world's oceans. And each year, the oil industry bring production wells online in waters deeper than the previous year. Underwater parks, memorials, and reserves will expand in size and scope until the Titanic, if there's anything left, is easily visited by tourists using teleoperated robots from the comfort of their home, from their home-based telecommunication centers. When ships and other pieces of human history fall into the deep abyss, they enter a deep freeze, characterized by eternal darkness, freezing temperatures, and enormous pressures. Some estimate that there is more human history preserved in Davy Jones's locker than all the museums in the world combined. During the 6 centuries that marked the rise of the fall and fall of the Roman Empire, Imperial Rome lost more than 10,000 commercial ships in the deep waters of the Tyrrhenian Sea, which is just a small sea off the west coast of Italy. Last year, we discovered and explored many of the Allied and Japanese ships lost in the cold, deep waters of Iron Bottom Sound off Guadalcanal. Ships that still have their camouflage paint clearly visible, their torpedoes still loaded, and depth charges resting in their racks. Ships with their main guns still pointed at one another as if the battle was still engaged. The Black Sea and its anaerobic bottom water will give up some of the oldest and best preserved wooden ships in the world, perhaps lost at a similar time when Jason and his Argonauts traversed these same waters in search of the Golden Fleece. On a far less glamorous note, landfills will give way to the placement of waste in the vast abyssal depths of the sea, perhaps ultimately the storage of nuclear material. We cannot continue to place our waste materials in our own backyard, only to have it pass through the drinking glasses of our children on its gravitational journey to the sea. We continue to hope for solutions to our waste problems, which are not coming fast enough to keep up with our exploding population and the creation of our complex waste byproducts. Our present strategy goes something like this. If we force people to live in their waste, they will think of ways to clean it up. By placing it in the sea, it would be out of sight, out of mind, and a solution will not be solved, even if placement in the sea is a wise alternative. Present law now forbids us from even conducting the basic research to determine if the sea is a reasonable alternative. Dare we gamble with the lives of the next generation on a prayer and a dream by continuing to pollute our drinking water? Even when you include the heavy taxation on gasoline, and it went up today, high octane at the pump head, if you go to the down to your local guy and pay for gasoline and add all those taxes, it costs less per volume than Perrier. And the price of drinking water will only rise until wine is a cheaper alternative, which might not be that bad, actually. People are already living in their wastes, and they still can't do much about it as the solutions continue to elude us. In recent years, we've discovered major mineral deposits in the deep sea, similar to those that for centuries were mined on the island of Cyprus and were a point of many wars. They contain high concentrations of copper, lead, and sulfur, as well as silver and gold. And their formation continues today in the vast hydrothermal vent systems of the mid-ocean ridge. These long linear deposits will be continue to be processed by Mother Nature, and we can actually, and I foresee their processing being done by the very geothermal energy that led to their formation. Some of these magnificent vent systems will become the Yellowstone Parks of the deep sea, leading to further arguments over their commercial versus their tourist value. The unique chemosynthetic life forms that we discovered in these vents that are processing toxic materials will hopefully be bioengineered to convert a portion of our waste products to less harmful or even commercially valuable byproducts. These exotic creatures will also help us understand the origin of life on our planet, as well as the potential for life on other planets which we once ruled out for their lack of a friendly nearby sun. Other life forms will prove to be important players in future pharmaceuticals. We know, for example, that hydrothermal vent animals are processing carcinogenic materials, yet none have any tumors. Whether this all occurs during the next generation's time on Earth, well, time will only tell. But the seeds of all that I have said can already be found in programs presently underway. As was stated, this summer, We will travel to the waters off of Ireland, where the great luxury liner Lusitania was sunk by a German U-boat in 1917, helping to precipitate America's entrance into World War I. That expedition, which is being sponsored by the National Geographic Society, is just the first step in a long-term program to not only explore this historic shipwreck in hopes of solving a long-standing controversy over its potential lethal cargo, but also the beginning of a process to make the Lusitania the first in-situ museum on the floor of the ocean, accessed by shore-based visitor centers using remotely operated vehicle technology. Now, when Steven Spielberg shows an interest in the ocean's future, maybe my thoughts about the future aren't that crazy. For the last 2 years, I've been working with Steven's creative talent base at Amblin Entertainment and Universal Studios to create a major new television series for the fall season on NBC entitled Sequest. 22 hours of primetime television on Sunday night at 8 o'clock up against Murder, She Wrote. That's a good one. Dedicated to the future exploration and colonization of the sea. The series takes place 25 years into the future and features many of the futuristic scenarios I've just outlined. But if America hopes to play a leadership role in this brave new future, and I sure know it's in us, it's been programmed in us, we must prepare the next generation to meet this challenge. For the last 5 years, the Jason Foundation for Education, which I helped create with EDS and National Geographic, has sought to prepare that generation of future explorers by taking hundreds of thousands of young students on live voyages of exploration and discovery to the far corners of our planet. A few months ago, during our exploration of the Sea of Cortez, more than 750,000 students and 10,000 teachers had to study a difficult science curriculum for the opportunity to explore live the exotic life forms of and hydrothermal mineral deposits forming at the bottom of the Sea of Cortez in 7,000 feet of water. Now, during our 2 weeks of live exploration, young people at downlink sites around the world, as well as scientists in marine laboratories, actually took control of our exploration robot through the satellite link and operated it from thousands of miles away. Now, these are just three examples of ongoing programs I'm involved in which provide us with a glimpse of the future. But there is one final effort that should and hopefully will take place in the future, but is not on the drawing boards. And that is the establishment of the first inner space station, a permanent research station in the ocean which can be realized at a fraction of the costs associated with even the cheapest version of the outer space station program the president is now considering. In fact, almost all of the major components of an inner space station have already been built and successfully tested. More importantly, we're about to place them in mothballs. They are the nation's nuclear submarines, its deep diving research submarines, its deep diving rescue vehicles, which we have already spent billions of dollars to construct during the Cold War, yet they still have more than half their reactor life, and we're putting them away. As an undersea explorer hungry for extended bottom time, the peace dividend could make Jules Verne's 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea a real and an immediate possibility. A mobile station not established as a military outpost, but one which carries scientists and engineers seeking to better understand the sea's many diverse geologic provinces, its weather, its biodiversity, its resources, and how our species can use this region of our planet, which covers 70% of the Earth, to help us live in harmony with ourselves, as well as the other species and plants and animals on Earth that deserve a right to live here as well. Now, a final footnote. The pioneering spirit that led the Pilgrims to Plymouth, the Polynesians to Hawaii, and the Mennonites to the jungles of Belize still lives within us today. Think about it. Is Bosnia, Somalia, and a host of other trouble spots on the land masses sticking out of the sea a better place to live and raise a family than a not so technologically remote coral atoll in the South Pacific? If technology can make a beautiful, provide us with a beautiful place to live in the ocean, wouldn't you take your family there and start anew? Thank you very much.